Welcome to Morgan Lewis Podcast Central. This is a podcast recording from Morgan Lewis's April 21st, 2015 8th Annual Conference, Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices. Morgan Lewis partners Jed Wider and Timothy Levin chaired this 14-part in-depth discussion of U.S. and international advanced hedge fund topics focusing on manager and investor perspectives. Part 5, Dodd-Frank Developments and Derivatives. Josh Sterling, Thomas D'Ambrosio, Dan Badofsky, and Akshay Balani will discuss an overview of recent Dodd-Frank developments and issues regarding derivatives, including documentation and clearing. Now, on to the podcast.
Josh Sterling, I'm one of four partners here to speak with you today about the recent developments with the CFTC and derivatives regulation. I'm joined by Tom D'Ambrosio, Dan Badofsky, and Akshay Balani. We're all investment management partners in Washington and New York. So as you know, with the passage of Dodd-Frank and over the past 5 years, it's been an ongoing saga of developments in what was formerly a very unregulated market, both for asset managers that ran funds trading derivatives extensively, and more broadly, the derivative markets themselves. So today, in 25 minutes, we're going to give a bit of an update on some of the latest developments in this space. And those are our topics for discussion, which we'll delve into right now. So stepping back, if you think about derivatives regulation as a hedge fund manager, there are really two main themes that emerge from all the filaments that have been coming out of the CFTC, the SEC, and certainly Europe as well. Derivatives regulation post-Dodd-Frank can affect your firm and its clients really in two principal ways. You may or may not have to register with the CFTC as a sponsor of a fund, commodity pool operator, or your firm may need to register as a commodity trading advisor, one who has a contract to manage the money. So general partner, managing member in the former case, investment manager in the latter. Even if you don't need to register as a commodity pool operator or a CTA, you may nonetheless need to explore whether or not you can remain exempt. So it's sort of an ongoing process with each mandate or each change or addition to your strategy. Beyond that, of course, the second very important theme is that if you trade in the derivatives markets, they are extremely highly regulated. Those regulations are going to step up extensively. They certainly have under Dodd-Frank, and we think they will continue to do so, both from the CFTC, the SEC, certainly overseas, as you'll hear about later today, and as this notion of prudential regulation of asset managers takes root with the FSOC, there might be more to come in that way. So with that, to think about the first major theme, commodity pool operator and commodity trading advisor considerations. Really, the key takeaway about this is that, as everybody knows, in 2012 and 2013, firms had to look very hard at whether they had a high degree of derivatives exposure. They need to register with the CFTC for the first time. Those issues always come up with the launch of a new mandate because the CFTC takes a fund-by-fund or a commodity pool-by-commodity pool approach. So part of the playbook of launching a new fund or changing the strategy within a fund is always to constantly assess, can I remain exempt as the investment manager CTA or as the sponsor as a CPO? And we certainly list here and in the materials in our CPO CTA handbook very comprehensively the analysis that needs to be undertaken as your business evolves, whether you need to register or whether you can avoid registration. Importantly in that regard, non-US mandates are still relevant for this purpose, even though the clients, the funds are organized outside the United States. By having a place of business here, you may in fact need to register as a CPO or CTA, or at least think about analyzing your business to see whether you can remain exempt. There are a number of open issues that are probably a conference on themselves, but just a few things to highlight because they're really important practical considerations. The first is this question of, as a registered CPO, have you registered the right entity within your fund complex? There's been a debate over the last 3 years as to whether, you know, the general partner or managing member of each particular fund would need to register or if the investment manager could register. And the CFTC has taken a surprisingly fixed view on this. The requirement is typically for the general partner to register. That can be delegated out. They have a very precise set of requirements you must meet to have the investment manager instead of the GP register as a CPO. And your counterparties, sometimes your investors if they're registered, and certainly the markets themselves like the CME are actually asking the question now, have you registered the right firm as a CPO when you're looking to take on new subscriptions, enter into new trading agreements, or sign up for membership in an exchange? And so that has significant real-world impact, which is why we mention it. The last development I wanted to mention on this slide is that there is this harmonization between CFTC rules and SEC rules under the Jobs Act. If your firm chose to generally solicit for investors or wanted to be a little bit more expansive in its marketing, the CFTC rules previously prohibited that. That has now been expanded a little bit with the no action letter listed on our deck. Really quickly, probably the most important practical consideration firms are facing right now as registered CPAs and CTAs is the National Features Association, or NFA's, audit process. Firms that registered for the first time, like hundreds of others in 2012 and 2013, are undergoing their first audits. There is a basic process. I think the key considerations here are that the NFA, for better or for worse, can be a little loosey-goosey on their process. And it's very important that you act in a way that preserves the confidentiality of your documents when you provide them. They have a mechanism for it. It's important to follow that mechanism. It's equally important to explain to them when they come to audit your firm precisely who's who and what's what. Your fund structure, individuals, why you're registered, why you're exempt. Sort of having a day one presentation for them can make the audit process go more smoothly. Lastly, at the end of the audit, NFA has lately been requiring registered firms to sign a rep letter that we think goes a little too far. It's basically an attestation that you've given them everything and that you're not aware of nothing you've told them that they ought to have known in the course of their audit. So really a way for the NFA to protect itself. We think it's a very one-sided document. And as firms have been asked to sign it, we've been able to negotiate that document down to something more reasonable you can actually live with. So as we said, there's a lot more information sort of in our book on CPO CTA considerations. But turning to sort of the second theme, regulation of the markets themselves, we're going to start with the discussion of position limits.
Oh, thanks very much, Josh. I'm Tom D'Ambrosio. I'm in the New York office. And I'll speak for a minute or two about the position limits. In 2011, the CFTC finalized position limit rules that would apply to futures and derivatives. And those rules were adopted with a lot of controversy. As a matter of fact, one of the CFTC commissioners said that they were adopted without considering the costs that those rules would impose upon the public. And of course, that's a violation of the Administrative Procedures Act. And so the CFTC was taken to court, and those rules were vacated. So the CFTC has spent the interim period trying to swing again at the ball. And so currently, position limits are proposed. They are coming. There's no doubt about it. But they're in the proposed stage, and the comment period with respect to position limits and aggregation has been open and closed and reopened and just closed again. But you should expect that that they will be finalized at some point in time in the near future. So position limits apply to 28 physical, exempt, and agricultural commodity futures. And that's wheat, corn, milk, soy, cocoa, coffee, the metals, copper, silver, palladium, platinum, and the energies, gas, oil, gasoline, diesel. These futures contracts have position limits associated with them, but position limits will also apply to swaps that are economically equivalent. And an economically equivalent swap to the physical positions are those that are either linked to the price of the futures contract or are linked to the price at the delivery location of the futures contract. And the position limits, when they're imposed, will exist for spot month, single month, and all month periods. There are bona fide hedging exemptions that are available. They're available only for parties that are really commercial in nature and are using the contracts to be a substitute for a physical transaction, reducing the risks of the enterprise, and establishing positions and liquidating positions in a reasonable and commercial manner. Now, with respect to position limits, the rules contemplate that you look at the whole large picture in order to figure out what the position actually is. And so generally, a party has to aggregate all positions for which it directly or indirectly controls the trading or holds a 10% or greater ownership or equity interest in an account or position or has an express or implied agreement for trading the position or controls trading strategies and accounts or pools with substantially identical trading strategies. So those are the ingredients for aggregation. If those are present, you have to aggregate all those positions. And there are some exemptions that are worth noting, and that certain parties and certain positions will be able to take advantage of. The first big exemption is the independent account controller exemption. And that is, if you appoint an independent manager to manage the position, then you do not have to aggregate that position. That person, the person who's appointing the controller, is not able to exercise day-to-day control over the trading of the manager. The independent controller must truly act independently. It must be registered either as a futures commission merchant, an introducing broker, a CTA, an associated person, or the GP of a pool where the CPO is exempt. However, this particular exemption will not apply to spot month limits in the physical contracts. A second exemption exists for pooled accounts. And a pool participant does not have to aggregate the pool positions if there is a 10% or greater interest, unless that person is actually the CPO of the pool, or principal or an affiliate of the CPO, or it holds 25% of the pool where the CPO is exempt under the 413 exemption. There is another exemption that's available for persons who own an equity interest greater than 10%, but not more than 50% of an entity. But in that situation, the first person can't have knowledge of trading decisions. It needs to have independent trading systems. It needs to have written procedures for information barriers. It can't share employees that control trading decisions. And its risk management systems can't share information. So that's for the 10 to 50% ownership situation. And then finally, there is another exemption for ownership of interests greater than 50%. That's a very, very difficult exemption to satisfy. You have to apply to the CFTC in order to get it. It's not automatic that you would get that, but all of the ingredients for the prior exemption would be required. And additionally, you have to certify to the CFTC that the entity that is owned is not and is not required to be consolidated for accounting purposes. You have to demonstrate to the CFTC that procedures are in place that are effective to prevent coordinated trading decisions. Each representative on the board of the entity has to certify that they don't control the entity. You either have to certify that those positions that are held are either bona fide hedges, or that if they are speculative, they don't exceed 20% of the position. And finally, you have to agree that the entity will provide information upon a call by the CFTC. So that's the aggregation situation right now. I'll turn it over to Dan Badovsky.
Thank you. I'm Dan Badovsky, working in the New York office. And Josh, when he was introducing our remarks, was saying that these are highly regulated markets, the derivatives markets, which is actually kind of astonishing, because a few years ago, they were not regulated at all. They were entirely unregulated. And then Tom just gave you a glimpse of just how intense the rules can be. And what's really interesting, and there's no place where it comes up more, in my mind, where it comes up more obviously than in the world of margin for over-the-counter derivatives. And that's because you have a part of trading world where people developed methods of worrying about collateralizing their transactions and worrying about mitigating credit risk, and there were commercial ways of doing that. And now, imposed on that commercial reality are these new rules that are in proposed form, and it has created a huge amount of controversy in the industry, not just on the sell side, but on the buy side as well. And I think there has been a lot of concern as to how are these rules going to work in practice, what does it mean for us as buy side participants, what does it mean in terms of the economics of our trades, what are we going to have to do. And it's not really an accident that Dodd-Frank was enacted in 2010, and it's 2015, and we still don't have final margin rules. Part of what was going on is that Europe was getting their margin rules for over-the-counter trades put in place, and the U.S. had gotten ahead of them, but we waited until Europe had gotten their rules in place, and then we put our, or proposed their rules. Then we, in the US, re-proposed our rules, and there has been a lot of debate as to whether the US rules should be more in conformity with the European rules and where the opportunities for regulatory arbitrage might be. So it's been very controversial, and there are those people who are passionate about this, and I'm sure you've all spoken to some of them who can't believe that these margin rules are going to be placed on over-the-counter trades and will do everything in their power to try to change that. And in fact, I guess the answer is that there may be some room to cause some changes in the margin rules as they've been proposed. What I'm going to do is I'm going to take just a couple of minutes just to review the highlights of what the margin rules are about and where there's an update. So the first thing to know is that in the US, the rules are not in force yet. The implementation timing and the proposed rules from last fall was that by December of 2015 of this year, variation margin was going to go into place. And then there was going to be a phase-in of initial margin starting at the end of this year, going for another 4 years, depending on the aggregate cross-affiliate swaps notionals. And that ranged anywhere from 3 billion US to 4 trillion US. In this March, the BSBS and IOSCO in Europe announced a revision to their framework, and they essentially delayed the start of their over-the-counter margin rules for about 9 months. And while in the US we haven't done that formally yet, there's been talk, the Commissioner Massad has indicated publicly that he's going to delay the implementation of the final rules. Although I saw his comment saying a few months, I think the conjecture is that would also be for that same nine-month period, taking us out to September of 2016. So what are the products that are covered? Because this is a rule that is administered prudentially by bank regulators, and most of the swap dealers in the U.S. are prudentially regulated, it covers not only CFTC swaps, but it covers SEC swaps as well for those prudentially regulated banks. It means anything that's not standard. Interest rate swaps and CDS, total return swaps, non-deliverable forwards in currency, et cetera. So it's a very broad range of products. But even that has been the subject of some debate. It's a bilateral model, meaning that variation margin gets posted by both parties. You probably have heard that there was a legislative change in the Business Risk Mitigation and Price Stabilization Act of 2015 that essentially created a carve-out for commercial end users. But that doesn't affect so much of us because we are, for the most part, financial end users. Initial margin, generally all dealers have to do initial margin, and some users, if their portfolio notionals exceed a threshold amount, in the US it's 3 billion, there's a big debate as to whether that threshold should be changed to line up closer with the European version, which is at 8 billion euro. And there seems to be some openness to matching that European recommendation on the part of the US regulators. So that's a little bit of an update, and we'll see. I'll say a word about eligible collateral. Eligible collateral for variation margin under the proposed rules is cash only, which from a funds perspective can be a big pain since you have to generate the cash to post as margin. The CFTC is apparently amenable to expanding that list beyond cash, or perhaps just limiting it to cash for dealer-to-dealer trades. But again, this is not formal. This is something that is in the works, and people are looking very carefully at it. For initial margin, it's a much broader set of eligible collateral and includes cash and a broad range of securities subject to haircuts. Importantly, the initial margin can't be rehypothecated. I'm going to very quickly take about 30 seconds just to say the things that people are worried about that you'll have to do when this stuff goes effective. Negotiating agreements for the separation of initial margin and variation margin collateral flows, negotiating additional third-party custodial arrangements, including those as credit support documents, rethinking your netting sets and your ISDA master agreements, aggregating thresholds across affiliates, which could be a huge problem for people, amendments to your ISDA master agreements and CSAs to deal with the different types of collateral that are permissible, amending and adopting policies, and then, of course, the ever problematic concern of educating not only internally in your institutions, but your investors as well. So that's a quick word about margin, where we are, and Akshay Balani is going to talk about the next item.
I am. Thank you, Dan. Dan just spoke about margin with respect to uncleared swaps. I'm going to talk a little bit about clearing, and I think that's generally the direction that, you know, the OTC market has been heading since the first clearing mandates were brought about in 2012. So I've got a fun slide here that, just for those of you who are not familiar with clearing or haven't had, are not trading in interest rates or CDS, index CDS, which are currently the products that are subject to a clearing mandate. This is kind of what clearing looks like, and clearing actually and trade execution through a CEF or a DCM. You'll see that it's much more complicated than bilateral OTC trading. There's a lot more going on here. And the idea really is to eliminate bilateral counterparty credit risk, right? You know, and the other way to manage, one would call bilateral counterparty credit risk, or to alleviate systemic risk, is to apply margin to those uncleared trades. But in this scenario, we're talking about everyone facing a clearinghouse. So that's just the quick rundown on what clearing looks like. As I mentioned, the idea is to eliminate bilateral credit risk, query whether now you're reallocating that credit risk to the new world of intermediaries, the central clearinghouse, the FCMs that are now actually aggregating that risk as they're the conduit to the clearinghouse. But there are some upsides to clearing, I think. A lot of you folks probably have, if you're, like I said, in the rates class or trading in CDS, index CDS, have already kind of, you know, gone through the process of setting up arrangements to clear. You're actively trading and clearing and trading on exchange, and it's kind of the futurization of swaps, right? I think by and large, I think these guys would agree, it's gone pretty smoothly. But, you know, what's next for clearing? By the way, here's a list of, this is fairly dated, and no clearing pronouncements have been made for quite some time. As you can see, the last one was in 2012 by the CFTC. Importantly, the SEC has not done anything about clearing yet. There's some rules around how they're going to accept or the factors they're looking at for clearing. But so far, no news is good news, I think, for a lot of fund managers out there who are trading in security-based swaps. So what's next for clearing? There's a lot of noise now about NDFs, non-deliverable forwards, being the next products that would be subject to a mandatory clearing determination. Now, one thing that's interesting here is that it's going to be both in Europe and in the U.S. Theoretically, at least we've heard, is that possibly by November 2015, ESMA, which is the European regulator, may make a determination, or actually would become live in November 2015, and then possibly the CFTC would follow suit, which means that you might have NDF clearing live and exchange trading, which would follow shortly thereafter, by early 2016. There's a helpful memo that's been included in your handouts that explains all of the issues that are surrounding NDF clearing. Because it's going to be on both sides of the Atlantic, there's certain issues about how they're going to harmonize the product sets, how it's going to be phased in, is there going to create opportunities for regulatory arbitrage across the two regulatory regimes, and there's a whole host of issues that are being examined specifically with respect to NDF clearing.
I know we're plus time. There's just one more thing I wanted to mention, if we could advance it, just one slide, which is that Dodd-Frank substantially expanded the CFTC's enforcement powers in the derivatives markets to include, among other things, prohibiting certain disruptive trading practices. And the one catching a lot of attention lately is spoofing, the intentionally stuffing the lines with bids and offers with never having an intention to actually execute on those trades. Spoofing is a very amorphous concept. It's funny to think the U.S. Code actually has the word spoof in it now. That's the world we live in. There's a case currently before the court called the Kosha Panther trading case, where someone's actually been criminally indicted for 6 counts of spoofing and futures trading. It survived a motion to dismiss. What's significant about this case is really a couple things, and then we'll wrap up. One is, the person was sanctioned by the CME, fined by the CFTC, and is now facing time in jail. The regulators are working together very carefully. In addition, and this is the last thought, the regulators are reviewing the code for algorithmic trading, and they're reviewing how quickly manual orders are actually canceled. If they're canceled quicker than in the blink of an eye, they will investigate. So to get an inquiry about order cancellation from your broker or an exchange, it will not stop there. It could go criminal. It's important to understand your algorithms, whether they call for canceling in all circumstances or even in circumstances when the market moves in your favor, and to be able to explain why you might have fill rates in particular strategies in the low single digits. These are all things being examined quite closely. The director of the CFTC has said that he thinks there needs to be more case law developed by the CFTC. So it's an active area, and if you trade frequently in these markets, it's something you'll want to work very carefully with your trading teams and trying to understand.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
To listen to other panels from the 2015 8th Annual Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference, visit our Hedge Fund University at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity. If you have any questions or would like more information on the topics addressed in this podcast, please contact a Morgan Lewis attorney at morganlewis.com. This podcast is provided as a general informational service to clients and friends of Morgan Lewis & Bockius LLP. It should not be construed as and does not constitute legal advice on any specific matter, nor does this message create an attorney-client relationship. These materials may be considered attorney advertising in some states. Please note that any prior results discussed in the material do not guarantee similar outcomes. Read more about Morgan Lewis and its hedge funds practice at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity.